Hello, it's Antrese, and welcome to another episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast. Savvy Painter is the podcast for painters who know that mastering your craft is a lifelong venture. They understand that the hardest part is showing up every day, whether they're inspired or not, and that we're all in this together. For the past 3 years, the Savvy Painter Podcast has been sharing tips and techniques that you can use every day in your studio. And when you join the Savvy Painter email list now, you get a collection of inspiring quotes and practical advice collected from years of Savvy Painter interviews. Just go to savvypainter.com/subscribe to sign up for weekly emails and get your free PDF, Essential Tips for Artists. Each week, I interview established artists like Anne Gale, Scott Connery, Rebecca Crowell, and many other artists who are willing to open their studio doors, share their painting processes, and talk candidly about what it takes to consistently grow your skills. We get into the nitty-gritty of their daily studio practice, what tricks they play on themselves to avoid getting caught up in perfectionism, how to use flashcards as reminders to stay on track during long painting sessions, and other cool tactics to quiet the inner critic and continue moving towards excellence. The Savvy Painter Podcast is filled with artists who generously share their stories, and by sharing their stories, they show the rest of us that we are not alone. So join us with the Savvy Painter email list and get even more connected with weekly emails. Sign up now and you get Essential Tips for Artists, the inspiring quotes and practical advice collected from years of Savvy Painter interviews. Go to savvypainter.com/subscribe. It's that easy. My guest this week is Gabriella Deloso. She's a narrative painter known for her homage portraits. Gabriella paints historical representations of women artists using herself as a model. In this episode, Gabriella shares how she found her voice and discovered her passion. For those of you who write in asking about how to find your voice, Gabriella's story just might help. It has a lot to do with staying focused and giving yourself the time to explore. And when I say time to explore, I mean more than 20 minutes here and there. It's a long process, but so worth the investment. We talk about her evolution, moving from freelance illustration into painting full time. Gabriella shares some hilarious stories of her mom dressing up in costume to model for her, even sewing costumes. Absolute proof that moms will do anything for their kids. Then Gabriella shares the stories of some of the women artists that she has painted. She does extensive research and really gets to know who they were and what their struggles and triumphs were. Many of these artists I had never heard of, but Gabriella has absolutely piqued my interest to dig a little bit deeper and find out a whole lot more. So without further ado, here is Gabriella Deloso. Gabriella, welcome to the Savvy Painter Podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with me here today.
Hi, Antrese. Thank you so much for having me. I love your show.
I would love to hear about your early days as an artist. What was it that made you decide that you were going to dedicate your life to this big, audacious endeavor?
Well, you know, I always loved art. Since I was a little girl, I was always drawing. I loved to draw and tell stories in my drawings. It's kind of interesting. I was thinking about this the other day. I used to like create these comics of families that would travel all over the world. And I had hundreds of these stories. And I would sit for hours doing this. And so I kind of always enjoyed drawing. And as I went through high school and I had to decide what I was going to do, that was my first love. But, you know, you have to be realistic. And what are you going to do to earn a living? You know, you have to go to college, and what do? So I chose psychology. And I love science too. So I kind of said, okay, psychology. So I started doing that. And I learned that you could make money illustrating. So that kind of changed things for me a little bit. I decided to go and study at the School of Visual Arts. And I pursued illustration. And that went on, you know, I was there for a while. I left school and I started getting assignments. I was like, it was the most exciting thing. I mean, I guess that's when you're considered professional, but...
Yeah, it's that first assignment. I studied illustration too. And the first time anyone ever paid me to do it, I almost felt guilty. I was like, I'm taking your money to do something that I love and that I would be doing anyway. And I caught myself in that thought that like, there's something wrong. They're paying me to do this.
I know. I was so excited. I mean, it was very, very exciting. And in those days, you'd go around with your portfolio into like different publishing houses. And I'm remembering how nervous I used to get bringing that portfolio around. And it was just, it was so important to me. And I'd get jobs, you know, and it was a very interesting thing.
So you're originally from New York, correct?
Yes.
So do you remember that I know what that felt like, but for me, the email was just starting. So you could kind of get away with doing a little bit over email. And that was really exciting because it showed you were super technologically advanced using email. But I was trained to really concentrate on the presentation of your portfolio and all the things that you were supposed to do when you go into some, you know, they talked a lot in my school about editorial publishing was sort of like the big thing to get into. And so they talked a lot about going into the publishing houses in New York.
Yeah.
I'm really curious. Do you remember like that first time, like you kind of stepped into the lobby and you're like, oh, I'm here.
You know what? I remember I had my portfolio with me and I had a panic attack. I was so nervous. And in this instance, I had left my portfolio and the art director, he was going to come back out with the portfolio and I was actually going to see him. And I panicked because I didn't expect that. And I was like, oh my God, he's going to come out. And I kind of like, I got very, very nervous. And I don't even know if like, I think I lost my voice and I didn't get the job.
But I can draw.
Oh my God, I know. So yeah, so that was very, it meant a lot to me, you know. I was at a school and I was like bringing this incredibly, I worked so hard on it and it was like my life's work in this portfolio and it was being judged by this person, whether I was worthy or not to do the work for him. And all of these things are just, you know, they go through your mind. And so, yeah. So, I mean, after a while, I got used to the process and it got better. I did get some work and I did do that for a while.
When did you transition to painting for yourself as opposed to being a commercial illustrator?
I did illustration for, let me think, that must have been like maybe 4 or 5 years, maybe 5 years. And I started to realize that it wasn't exactly what I was cut out for. On one hand, it was really wonderful to see the work like printed and all of that. But on the other hand, some companies would write out the story and exactly to what was on the kitchen shelf, like how many jars they wanted. And I was like, you know, I started to question this. I'm like, is this what I really love to do? I wasn't a top tier illustrator. I wasn't given the freedom to do like whatever I wanted to do. I had to really follow these directions and I wasn't loving it. So I said, I don't know if I want to do this anymore. So luckily, what I had been doing was studying painting and drawing at the Art Students League during the time I was illustrating. So what I would do is I would do a class in the morning. I would go paint from the model, and then I would come back home and do the assignments. So I would be splitting my time between working on the model and then coming home and doing the assignments. Mm. And yeah, so I was doing both those things, and I started to realize I wasn't loving doing these things. I mean, I did have some fun experiences. Like I illustrated a book on Neanderthals.
Oh, wow.
And my mother was a victim, I tell you. She would do anything for me. I love you, Mom. She would put on the fur skin and this crazy like Neanderthal wig, and so it was like priceless. I mean, it was just amazing what she would do. She's just the best. And so anyway,
I'm just picturing this. I hope you have photos of this, like behind the scenes photos. That is so classic.
I had some very unique, interesting experiences. Another time she was a pilgrim and like she had to like beat up this wolf. And she was it was amazing. She was so convincing how angry she was. And I never forgot that. I was impressed by it, like the genuine anger that came out of her. So anyway, so she was a great model, and she is still to this day. So I kept painting at the school. And I really minimized doing the commercial work. And I kept going and going, and I kept studying the painting from life. And I said, you know what? I love telling stories. I mean, I really want to start doing some of my own paintings. So I started doing paintings for myself while I was in class. And I think I started with self-portraits. I started, like, I always collected costumes and stuff like that. I kind of drew off of that. I've always been a thrift shopper. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to put these two together. And that's how that started.
That is such an interesting place to be in, though, because so what I'm imagining is you'd already graduated from school once and you were, you know, sort of in the career mode and realized you wanted to make a switch. But so these classes that you were taking are the sort of classes that you could go on indefinitely, right? You know, probably, like every school has, you know, night programs or something. You just take these one-off classes.
Yeah, yeah. So you can go in, you paint from the model, and it's a wonderful experience. I love doing it. Yeah.
And I can see at some point, you need to sort of turn off. It's that part of turning off the voices in your head, so to speak, turning off the instruction and just being quiet enough to hear your own voice.
Exactly. And so when I decided to become just totally independent, I was like, I'm blank. It was the weirdest thing. It was like there was nothing on the slate there.
Nobody's telling you what to do.
I know. So it was a kind of an odd thing. And so then I was like, okay, I think I need some sort of a theme. And, you know, I came up with clowns. I know that sounds weird, but
there's a lot of people that are really scared of clowns, Gabriella.
I know. I've heard that over and over again over the years, but I'm not one of those people.
Well, to be fair, I think your clowns are like, when I imagine a clown, I picture like the ball on the nose and the red hair and the giant shoes and all that. And yours are more the classic clowns, right? The sort of,
yes,
they feel like 200 years ago clowns.
That's exactly the type I love.
I know that a lot of people listening to this podcast, that there's this transition period, right, of either being literally a student where you're going into class at a university, or you're doing that type of studying where you're handpicking classes and dropping in on workshops consistently here and there, or studying on your own. And you're kind of in that really learning phase and taking other people's advice, instructions, and how things should or shouldn't be done. And that moment that you're talking about right now is kind of a scary moment. It's kind of like the little bird leaving the nest and flying off on its own. when you came up with this series and when you started thinking to yourself that, okay, that there's that moment of where everything's blank and you're like, I'm by myself. I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
How long did that last for you? What can you describe that a little bit and how you kind of came into that realization that you needed to make a series and that, you know, like this was something that you needed to do to grow as an artist?
You know, I was doing my own paintings while I was in school, mm-hmm. but at home. But I was all over the place. Like, I mean, I did, that's kind of when I was like recruiting my mom. Like, I'm like, you've got to pose for me, please. So I would have her in these different poses and she would sit for me. So this was a really nice thing. But the paintings weren't exactly tying together. The first painting I did before I decided to do the clowns, and maybe I'm just thinking, maybe it catapulted me into choosing the clowns, was one where she was sitting at a sewing machine. And I set this setup up where I had an old-fashioned sewing machine, and there were all these puppets, and she was like sewing puppets, and some of the puppets were clowns. And I had the sewing machine light on, and it was very dramatic. And so, I don't know, maybe something about that struck me. And I'm like, I kind of like, I like the painting too. It came out kind of neat.
Do you still have it?
Actually, somebody owns that painting, but I have photos of it, and I look at it from time to time, and I'm like, oh, that was a neat painting. You know, it's a little different in style, but it was a little more impressionist. But I liked the way I caught the light, and the puppets were kind of interesting to me. They were colorful, and so I'm just realizing this is probably what made me do the clowns. The clown puppet, I actually still have that painting. So then I kind of said, okay, this is what I'm going to do. And I also saw this old Victorian postcard of this clown. And it was so beautiful. It was really classic looking clown. He had like ruffled pantaloons. And it was just so enchanting to me. So you know what, the very first piece I did of the clown series I'd had was a Victorian bubble blower, and it was a drawing, and it was of course of my mother the clown. This is where she actually first started helping me make the costume. And I was like, I'm like, Mom, you've got to see this postcard. I love it. And so we were both looking at it, and I kind of bought these like ruffled pantaloons, and like I had to make the top. And so she helped me with that. And she was a really good model, where she let me paint her face white, and you know, so anyway, so it was a lot of fun. That was my first one, and I put that together, and I liked what happened with that.
Do you have any advice for people who are sort of in that position of trying to find that voice, that thing that they, you know, going from having so many voices and so many people telling them, not in a bad way, but, you know, helping them learn how to paint. And so naturally you're going to try to, I don't think impress is really the right word, but try to use the techniques that you've been taught by that particular instructor. And so when you sort of leave the nest and you make that leap and you have that, after that moment of silence where you realize nobody's going to tell you what to do, it's all on you.
Yeah.
Do you have advice for people who are in that position? Because I know you also teach, and so I'm curious if you get these questions.
Well, you know, I think when you start doing your own paintings, the most important thing is you have to find something you're passionate about. So that's going to be the hard part. And I mean, it's not the hard part. It's how are you going to translate it into your own painting? Mm-hmm. Because you can be passionate about something and you don't make that translation.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the trick. I mean, it's interesting. When I was doing all of this, there was no social media. There, you know, the internet was, it was starting out, but it wasn't like it is now.
No.
Yeah. So I kind of wonder about that. I'm telling you, I kind of think I've been doing this social media thing for a little while now. I don't know, 2 years, 3 years. And you know what? I kind of feel, I've realized it's a bit of a distraction. It has its good things.
You don't say. Mean,
I know, right? So it's like, at first it's like, wow, you get to see this, you get to see that. But then it's like, okay, this I am seeing now in reality. And it's addictive too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause you want to see what's going on. And
yeah. And make no mistake about it. That's on purpose. I mean, they have entire departments. There are like hundreds and hundreds of high-level graduate degrees in psychology and user interface and all that, trying to figure out how to keep you on Facebook or Instagram as long as possible.
Yeah, it's a very interesting thing. I mean, but I've started to realize that, and I'm like, wow. And so to me, that it's interesting because I'm kind of happy I didn't have that when I decided to start my own paintings, because I think you need to be in your own space.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have so much information constantly coming into your mind, I don't know. I mean, I think it's kind of distracting, and I'm not sure you can achieve what you seek in terms of your own voice. Will there be too many influences? You know what? Maybe that's a matter of your personality. Maybe it depends on your personality, but I find for myself that I have to be totally in my own bubble.
Yeah.
And I have to like be focused on, is this going to work? And is this really saying what I want? And if you get carried away with like things that don't matter, the painting might not come off like you want it to.
Yep. Yeah, I think, you know, it's really interesting that we have this, those of us who were alive before social media. I think the internet was, the internet just meant that I didn't have to drive to the library at first. You know?
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah.
At first, that's kind of all it was. And I could, and I didn't have to go to the post office, and I didn't have to drive to the library. But those weren't things that were like, you know, every 5 minutes, something that needed to happen, right?
Yeah.
So I you know, people who sort of have that advantage were used to spending long periods of time, I mean, 8-10 hours just sitting in their studio working without ever even thinking about doing anything else. And now I feel like even when you want to do what's called deep work, you are constantly battling, I think, this idea that it's constantly in your head saying no to checking your phone, checking your email, checking whatever it is. So it's there in your head where that wasn't even a consideration before. It just wasn't, didn't exist. If that makes any sense. So I think there's this, you know, in terms of like the amount of willpower that we have, we're using a lot now to resist all these distractions.
Yeah, that's very true. And you know, what's interesting for artists is everybody wants to be good. We all want to be good artists. And, you know, it is competitive in a sense. And that right there is, I guess, the downfall of the whole thing. It's like a catch 22 because, okay, you want to be in this, the whole art world, you want to be taken seriously. So you're like, oh, I've got to see what's going on, what's happening. But then on the other hand, what does art really mean? Is that what it's about? Is it about that thing where you want to be accepted by the world and you want to be in the running or whatever? Does that really make your voice what you want it to be? Is that a distraction?
Mm.
It's interesting. I mean, I think the best artists who are really good are in their own zone. Mm-hmm. I really don't think they're sort of looking at other people too much. I think they're totally devoted. It's like a devotion. Like, I mean, the really good ones, they're just devoted to that art. It's a beautiful thing. I mean, I've seen it and I've admired it, and it's an inspiration.
It is, yeah. And it's sort of, it's a huge question and it's intimidating, right? Because if you think about it too much, then it's you, I don't know, speaking for myself, if I think about it too much, I'm almost like a deer in the headlights, like I can't do that. But if you think about what's your legacy going to be, and is the art that you're making going to matter two generations after you're gone? That's a lot of pressure.
It's a lot of pressure. I know, right?
So that's why I don't like to think about it. I just want to paint and not worry about that and just make the art that is speaking to me now. And that's for somebody else to decide.
Exactly. And I think in order to be able to put yourself into it and that love of your art and how you love the art and to really make it grow, you have to be totally focused on it. Totally focused on it. Mm-hmm. So that's where the social media thing makes things kind of difficult, because it's like you have too many images in your mind. You know, it's like when you're looking, it's different than when you go to a museum and you walk around and you sort of see the real thing and you kind of study certain things. And even in a museum, like, I can't walk through a museum and go to every single room. I have to be selective and just like take in a few things.
Yeah.
And then think about it. But imagine like with this social media, it's like you're bombarded with like image after image after image. And that is interesting for an artist, a visual artist, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, I can imagine if how musicians feel. I don't know if it's the same thing, but the visual artist has to deal with that. And I don't know. I think for somebody coming out of school wanting to create their own thing, I think that would make it harder.
I think you need a lot of uninterrupted time and... So that's sort of like on a micro level, you need a lot of uninterrupted time, but I think you need a significant chunk of years to explore a subject and really, you know, I think to me, that's what, when I see artists who I think are really great, they have latched on to something and have just allowed themselves to be obsessed for decades without worrying about what that means or what that is, it going to bore my audience, even the fact that we have an audience, you know?
Yeah.
I know. I just catch myself saying things that I'm like, that wasn't even a thing 20 years ago or 30 years ago.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, it's incredible though. Like you have that audience, you can reach so many people, which is amazing. But it's got this downfall too. So I think there's a learning curve with it. That's what I'm finding with myself. I definitely think there's a learning curve with social media. Yeah. And you kind of have to like realize what it means to you and your art. And you have to decide how you want to use it.
Yeah. And in terms of the distraction thing, I'm just thinking of this right now, but it sort of reminds me a little bit. I come from a really big family. And so when I was a kid, I was very capable of sitting in a room with five brothers and sisters around me, the TV blaring, phone ringing, you know, just a complete cacophony and just all the distraction. And I could sit there and read a book.
Me too.
And be completely unaware of the conversations that were around me, or, you know, it would take my brother throwing a pillow at my head to get me to look up and be like, what? You know, what did you say? And it wasn't that I was hearing it. And it was just like, now the interesting thing is that, you know, now that I'm not in that situation anymore, and after college, I lived by myself for a long time. And so I got used to quiet. And now if there's somebody in the other room talking and I'm reading a book, I'll read the same paragraph like three times because it's just, it distracts me that much. And it's just so interesting what we can adapt to. And so I think that there's that same sort of maybe adaptation that we need to figure out with social media, the internet and all that, just to be able to tune it out and do the work and, and just kind of go into our own little world and stay there regardless of what's happening all around us.
That's true. It's interesting. I'm exactly like you. I would have the TV on. I could study with a lot of noise, and now it's changed. But I think for me, the social media is distracting because it has to do with the art.
Mm.
And so it's something I'm truly interested in. So like that topic really grabs my attention. So it's a battle. It's a battle. So it's a tough thing. It's a tough thing, but there's a learning curve. There's definitely a learning curve. So, I mean, I don't know how people's brains develop, but if you grew up with social media and your brain is maybe adapted to it, maybe it's a good thing. Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, who knows?
Yeah. It might be how I was as a kid, and people would be like, how can you even do that? You know, like I could sit there and read Shakespeare with the Rolling Stones playing in the background and my brother's like, you know,
yeah.
It's kind of amazing what you're able to do. So maybe this is just a generational thing that for whatever reason, I haven't learned to quite tune it out yet.
Yeah.
What are you currently working on? What are you currently obsessed with? Are you still dressing your mom up as a clown?
I'm not actually. Her modeling days. I mean, I'm not going to say they're over, but
she's on sabbatical, maybe.
She's on sabbatical. Yes. I have to really do something special to get her to model for me. Yeah. I mean, she's not the center of the paintings anymore. I'm not saying she won't be, but now I'm currently working on a series on historical women painters. They're homage paintings. I call them homage paintings. And what I decided to do there was I use my self-portrait and I reenact. I'm the actor. So rather than use my mother, I'm the actor. I recreate these artists. And I mean, I love doing it. I think they're so interesting. There's so much I never knew about women painters. I grew up and I was always at the Met with my dad and we'd visit Rembrandt, like he was obsessed with Rembrandt. Mm-hmm. And I love Rembrandt, 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 Rembrandt. But in school, I never learned anything about women painters. It's very interesting.
So what has surprised you about some of the artists that you've learned or discovered?
You know, what I find so interesting, their life stories are so interesting. I mean, they did art and they were damn good at it when they weren't even being taught the rules. You know, they had to learn sideways. They had to learn behind the scenes. And if they wanted to become professionals, I mean, you can only imagine trying to do something when there were no women doing it. And so I just find when I read about them, how they were so determined and things happened to them, but they didn't let that get them down. You know, I kind of find their stories really interesting and inspiring, what they were able to achieve and a lot of discoveries, you know, things you would say, you would say, wow, I never imagined that.
Yeah, somebody asked me recently if I could live in any time period, what time period I would live in. And I remember as a kid, I could think of 100 I would want to live in because I thought it was just so fascinating. And now I'm like, nope.
Yeah.
I'm good right here.
Because I know.
I don't Absolutely. Think I could handle living in that world where, it would just be so awful. Like now that you're kind of like older and you kind of understand actually what all that meant, I just can't even. It's amazing.
Yeah, it was hard for them.
Do you have an example of an artist whose story stands out for those reasons?
Well, I mean, there's so many stories. My favorite historical woman painter is Adelaide Labille-Guyard.
I have never heard of her.
She was an amazing painter. And if you go to the Met, you should definitely visit a painting called Self-Portrait with Two Pupils. And she's wearing a magnificent, I mean, people know how much I love this painting because I always talk about it. It's one of my top five of all time favorite paintings. She's wearing a light blue satin dress. And she has two of her students standing behind her. And they're kind of peering over her shoulder as she looks at the audience. And basically, to make a long story short, she lived during the French Revolution. And they didn't allow women to exhibit, really. They had an academy, the Royal Academy in Paris. And it was all male except for four women painters at one time. So she was one of the four, and she taught females. So she was a teacher, which I also find inspiring for that time period. And so in her painting are two of her students, and she painted them in, and she exhibited this painting in the Royal Salon exhibition. And it was in a bit of a way sarcastic, because she was like, okay, so here are these two, my two, you didn't want them in the show, but they're in the show via my painting. So I kind of like that story. And anyway, so I just find her so interesting. I mean, she lived through the French Revolution. She never left Paris. I can imagine how brave that must have been for her to stay during the revolution. I mean, so many changes and so many things going on, but she stayed. And it was amazing because she painted the royalty. And as you know, they were being executed and all of that. And she was suspected of being on the side of the royalty. But I mean, I think she was well liked. I mean, I imagine what she must have been like. She must have been a strong lady because she lived through all that stuff and she wasn't executed. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I find that really inspirational. I've done a few paintings about her. I did my biggest painting about her, and she did one painting that was burned, and it was her most complicated one. And I think it would have been her masterpiece, and the revolutionaries burned it. So I was like,
oh,
yeah, it was horrible. Anyway, so I kind of was like, I said to myself, I read this and I'm like, I'm going to do a painting about this, because she spent 2.5 years painting something that had like over 30 figures and they just burned it. And yeah, it was a horrible, horrible thing. So I did a painting so people would know she attempted something that only males would do. Those history paintings. And so she ventured into that. She was moved into a huge, huge painting studio. I think it was a library. It was so big, they had to move her into a library so she could paint it.
This painting that they burned, you're talking about?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's how big it was. So anyway, so I find her an incredibly inspiring person because she was so good, and she lived. Imagine, not only were women not allowed to do all these things, but she also lived through wars and revolutions and chaos and
crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I say that I couldn't live in another time period, I kind of think I'm just not strong enough. Like those women were just, you know, they were kind of warriors in the sense that they found ways, because I'm sure they had to navigate this sort of social political system in order to do what they need to do and bite their tongues way more often than I feel like I would be able to.
Oh, yeah. And I think painting was not considered an appropriate occupation for a woman.
No, not at all. And I'm kind of thinking, too, like when, you know, when she was teaching, because I know women weren't allowed in there because, oh my gosh, seeing somebody nude would just destroy her composure, I guess.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Yeah, they were not allowed to study the nude. They mm-hmm. were not allowed. They were segregated. And she ran her own atelier, and, you know, she was good enough to have the pupils. So mm-hmm. it's amazing. She was really an interesting person.
Who are some of the other artists that you feel like people should know about that don't, you know, like, so as an example, she sounds amazing. And now I'm going to go look up all of her work. But honestly, I'd never heard of her. Who else should I know about?
There's an artist called Giovanna Garzoni. She does such delicate, wonderful paintings of like fruits and bowls. Very beautiful. She painted for the Medicis. Very, very, very beautiful still lives.
That seems like it, especially the Medicis. That seems like that would be extraordinarily rare.
I know.
Because then she's competing, you know, she's competing against Caravaggio. She's competing against those kind of artistic legends. And I'm sure that from what I understand of that time period, they really protected their commissions and their patrons.
Yeah.
In the sense that they didn't want to share.
Well, I mean, she painted still lives. So that was deemed more appropriate for women. A lot of women did more still life painters. She was an exquisite, exquisite still life. You've got to see her work. It's just so delicate. Beautiful, beautiful work. Another artist, Rachel Riusch. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. The most gorgeous florals. I mean, she was like completely gifted artist, really, really beautiful arrangements. I mean, and what's incredible about her is she was so, so prolific. She really painted tons of these wonderful arrangements. I think they're almost like compositions like music. Mm. Yeah, they're very musical florals. And she was born with this gift. I mean, just incredible, you know. She was from the Netherlands. So very, very interesting floral painter. Anna Vallière-Coaster, she was from the time period where Adelaide Labille-Guillard painted. And she painted terrific still lives. I mean, some people said she was better than Chardin. Beautiful arrangements. Very, very beautiful arrangements. So, I mean, the list goes on and on. Yeah. There's so many.
Yeah.
They're just some terrific, interesting painters that, I mean, you learn about them. There's an Italian painter, early painter, Sofonisba Anguissola, and her life story is super interesting. She actually crossed paths with so many old masters. You wouldn't believe it. She studied under Michelangelo for, I don't know how long it was, a short time, but he critiqued her drawing and he challenged her to create a drawing that expressed, I think, somebody frowning, because she had given him a drawing of somebody smiling. And he's like, well, do a drawing of somebody frowning. So she came up with this idea, a drawing of her little brother being bitten by his finger being bitten by a crab. And he was kind of like in mid, I know, sort of in mid action with his finger. And you know what? An art historian compared that to Caravaggio's Boy Bitten by Lizard. Mm-hmm. And they say he got that idea from Sofonisba. So that's kind of interesting.
That's very interesting. Because when you said it, that was the first thing I thought of, was that Caravaggio with the lizard.
Yeah, because she did that like 40 years before Caravaggio. So it's kind of an interesting, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, little things like that you find out. And I mean, she was just a very she lived in her 90s, I think. And
wow.
But yeah.
For like that time period, that is, the expected lifespan was like 40 something, right?
I know. It is incredible. I mean, I'm like, look at her and I'm like, wow, this woman was amazing. You know, Van Dyck visited her when she was in her 90s, and she worked for the Spanish court. and she entertained Van Dyck with her stories of like the year she spent in the Spanish court. And
wow.
he painted her and drew her, I think. So, I mean, she did, I think Rubens copied one of her paintings, you know? So it's kind of like, I know. So it's like all these interesting stories you find out.
Oh, I love it. Would you be willing to just sort of do a brain dump, make a list of these artists that you've been looking into? And send me an email with them, because I know what's going to happen. People are going to email. People are going to be like, who are they? Where are they? Where can I find them?
Okay.
So yeah, just sure, enough that like they can, you know, we'll just do a list and people can Google them and, you know, go down their own rabbit holes.
Okay. Yeah. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Course.
I would love it.
That's kind of like the whole idea of it. Like, let's talk a little bit about these super interesting people. They were like these life stories. And Sofonisba, so interesting story. Her first husband died, and in her late 40s, she remarried, okay, which was so unusual.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like a sea captain.
The second husband was a sea captain.
He was a sea captain. Like, they apparently like just fell in love, and she married the sea captain. So I don't know. I just find the whole story just so romantic. I'm like, wow. You know, like, hundreds of years ago, and this woman was like unbelievable. You couldn't stop her from creating her art and happiness. So
my hero. Wow.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, so cool. So you've done paintings of her?
Yeah, well, I did a self-portrait drawing of her.
Rest, okay.
Yeah, I did like a bust type of thing. I do drawing portrait busts, and she was one of them. And it's interesting because, you know, I've written about her and I did this drawing. And when I was first doing the drawing, I said to myself, because sometimes I feel this kind of connection to these artists. Like, I'll just feel like I'm connecting with them. But in this case, I wasn't sure. I'm like, am I feeling this connection? I don't know. I wasn't sure of it. And so this is so interesting. In that day that I thought that, I had this movie on. Sometimes I'll put a movie on in my phone, and I'll put it on the easel as I'm working, just for a little kind of like noise or something going on.
Uh-huh.
It kind of keeps me focused on what I'm doing. And the movie was called The Last Offer. And the movie was about this guy. I didn't know. I just picked it on Netflix. Some kind of art collector who like falls in love with this woman. So anyway, he has this collection in the movie of these portraits of women, okay? And there was this one moment, one scene, where I looked down on my phone, and there was the portrait I was using as reference, the exact
Whoa.
Same portrait of Sofonisba Anguissola. I'm not kidding. It was, I had the book open to this portrait, and a flash of the same exact portrait on my phone in the movie of the, I was like, oh my God, is that like a sign or something?
Are we connected? Is she talking to me?
I guess maybe that's a sign that there was a connection. I don't know, but it's funny how like they're weird coincidences, you know?
Hmm.
So I kind of like, I mean, I love these painters, and I really do them out of like, wow. I'm like, I really admire them.
The subjects that you choose, these are all people who have painted a portrait of themselves, or there's some visual reference, or do you ever choose somebody and then just try to recreate a sort of historical costume from that time period? I guess I'm kind of curious, like, how deep do you go into this? Do you start with the portrait and then discover the artist, or do you discover the artist and then look for the portrait?
I mean, it depends on the painting. Like, most of them, I started doing just busts, like the portrait and then like the bust.
Mm-hmm.
And most of them had done the self-portrait, and I would use that and then kind of put my image into that. And that's kind of, I did a lot of those like that. But then I started doing stories, and I started doing more complex paintings. And so, to make a long story short, I started to use elements from their life or their compositions. Like there's an artist called Remedios Varo, and she's a surrealist, para-surrealist. She does magical paintings. I love her work. And she does not paint realistically at all. I mean, her figures are very non-realistic, and I could not possibly merge my image with her, one of hers. It just wouldn't make sense. But I love her subject. So I kind of was like, you know what? I'm going to recreate one of her paintings in a realistic style.
Ooh.
Yeah, since it's so not realistic, and I'm going to kind of change it around a little bit, put my own spin on it. So I kind of have done that. I've told the story of another artist who, she did a lot of paintings of bird eggs in their nests. And it's a long story, but I discovered her through an author who wrote a book called America's Other Audubon. And she wrote this book about this woman whose dream in life was to create a book about the eggs and nests of all the birds in America. And so there's a book that exists that catalogs nests and eggs. And that's why it's called America's Other Audubon. Mm-hmm. And I never had heard about her. But the story is a little tragic, where she never got to finish the book because she caught typhoid fever. But her family finished the book, and it was her lifelong dream to create this book. So I did a painting where she's against a tree dreaming of the illustrations in the book, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like, I mean, these are their stories. Whether or not I use an actual painting at this point, because it's evolved now. The mm-hmm. series has evolved. Like the last one I've been working on is a still life about these still life painters who didn't do portraits of themselves. And I actually used their still lives to create one great big still lives. I used three painters in one painting, their objects. And I created this big painting.
I want to see those.
Yeah, so I'll send you that. So it's kind of like, I mean, it depends on, it's about the idea. I kind of like expand it as I go.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's something I love doing. That's the important thing.
Yeah, it is. And it goes back to what we were talking about earlier about sort of finding your voice and finding that obsession and allowing yourself to start one place and for it to evolve. I mean, you started, it sounded like, doing these very traditional portraits, the busts, and then it sounds to me, at least, as your fascination grew, so did the paintings.
Yeah, I mean, they evolved. I kind of like went from just the simple, like you said, bustial. With that, I kind of, they look traditional, but they're almost like a morphing, I guess. I mean, I kind of like, I take my face and combine it with theirs. And I kind of try and use my likeness to like make people say, oh, who's that? Or how is she in there? Or whatever.
So I'm just kind of curious, like on a more nitty gritty technical piece of this, are you seeing these as sort of an adaptation of a master copy, in the sense that you take these paintings and you're copying what they do? And then this sounds like a really bad Photoshop job, which is not what I'm trying to say. But you know what I mean? So like incorporating yourself, really copying what they did and then adding yourself into it? Or do you dress up as that person and start from that image of you dressed up? Do you know what I mean? Like, I don't know if I'm asking it very well.
It's a very interesting process. It's not easy to do.
No, it doesn't sound easy at all.
Yeah, it's not that easy to do, because I have to like change the painting into myself. And I have, you know, you don't want it to look totally like them or totally like yourself. So this is like a push and pull type of thing.
But for the style of it, are you mimicking their style It sounds like you are. You're mimicking.
I started that way with that idea. And I always do try to incorporate them, whether it be their style or their feeling, into it. And I started more, when I started doing these, it was about trying to imitate the stylistic thing. Mm-hmm. But as I've gone on, I mean, I started doing these as drawings. And once I started doing the drawings, I realized you can't possibly make it their style because now it's a drawing. Mm-hmm. So then it became about just capturing the feeling of their personality in the likeness of myself. So it's like, am I capturing that? So yeah, so that's kind of what that's about. And that's a push and pull. That's hard to put your finger on.
Very.
That's like when I said, oh, I don't know if I'm feeling this, is that. And then I, you know, with the movie, I was like, okay, I'm on the right track here. Mm. So it's sort of a push and pull thing. I do look in the mirror to do these things. Sometimes I'm looking more at their painting and I'm like looking at the angles in their painting and I'm analyzing that. So it depends. A lot of it is like imagining it too, you know? Mm-hmm. Every artist is different. There's no formula for it.
That's what makes it, to me, sound like so much fun. And
yeah,
what it reminds me of, you know, the only vague experience I can say that I have with some, and it is a very, very distant cousin, I guess, was when I worked at Disney, every project, I would have to learn how to paint like in a different style to mimic whatever property that was. So, you know, like all the Disney Lion King or Pocahontas, or, you know, if you compare that to 101 Dalmatians, they are all extraordinarily different from each other. And so this just sounds like the really fun version of that.
I guess that's a good way to put it. Definitely. I mean, I definitely love doing them. They're difficult to do. Mm-hmm. And there's that push and pull, but maybe that's the fun.
And you're also, I mean, it sounds like you, in order to pull that off, which you do, you really have to challenge your painting skills with this. You can't ever just do it by rote.
No, you can't. There's no formula for this.
Yeah, there's no possible way that that could work.
Yeah. Yeah, because each one is different and you have to capture something there, and it's just done by the feeling of it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm by nature, and it's very interesting. I have two sides. I'm a bit sloppy, but then I'm also neat. And so I start my work in a sloppy way all over the place. And then I start to, it's kind of organic when I start, mm-hmm. very organic. I'm definitely not the type that'll start very perfect.
Yeah. Like you're not going to start with a grid.
I can't do it.
I can't either. I've never in my life used a grid. And when somebody tried to teach me, I was like, what?
I know. I'm like, please leave me alone.
I admire people who can do it because I feel it must make their lives so much easier. And why do I have to do everything the hardest way possible? But there you go.
You know what I've concluded about that? Because I also admire people who use grids. It's very interesting what I've concluded. I feel like everyone's different. Mm-hmm. And you have to look at like your parents and see whether or not they're the grid type. I mean,
oh, that's so funny. So that, yeah, no, absolutely not with my parents. No.
Okay. So that explains it, because like in my case, it's very interesting. My mom's very organic. Like she does things like by feeling and it's organic. My dad, on the other hand, oh my God, he is like perfectionist central.
Like an engineer.
Yes, he will fold towels like they look like they're from the department store.
Oh my God.
I mean, they're so perfect and he labels everything. I mean, he is like, I mean, I find that, I have to say, I find it incredibly inspirational that he's like that. But it's so different than my mom, which is very organic. So I try to take the best of both worlds. And I'm not going to force. I have both. And so you have to look at the parents and like, it's not your nature. Don't do it. If you have both sides, embrace both. If you're totally organic, go with it. I mean, some people are so mathematical. It's probably something in them that they mm-hmm. were born with, you know?
Oh, that's so interesting.
Everyone's different. I mean, certain types of artists I admire tremendously. They're so methodical. But I was not born this way. So mm-hmm. I have to like embrace the reality of who I am and just go with it and make the best of it.
It's so funny, though, how we resist that. I'm just thinking about how long it took me to start my paintings the way I want to start my paintings and to disregard everything that I was taught and just do it the way that comes naturally.
Exactly.
I resisted that and fought it for so long. And then finally, I just got to the point where, you know what? The police aren't here to like watch how I do, you know, the painting police aren't here watching how I start my painting. And it's nobody, you know, like it's so much more fun for me to do it my way.
Exactly.
It's just so interesting how long it took me to get there, though. I mean, like decades, I think. I don't know where I like at some, I would at least be thinking, oh, I should be doing it the other way.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that I went through also. But one thing for me, that feeling of it wasn't fun. It wasn't feeling like it was me. Like, I think it's really important technically, like you have to embrace who you are. For it to come out authentic, I think you have to come to terms with what you like and what's natural for you. Because as much as I admire very precise things, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just not totally that type of an artist. I mean, I have to come to realize what feels natural for me, and I have to work with it and really hone and perfect that natural, I guess, procedure for myself. And how can I make that the most efficient I can possibly make it for myself with all I've learned, not doing it a different way, not forcing it, not doing something, you know, it forces you to be inventive with yourself. Like, how can you achieve what you want and make it feel natural?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's kind of the challenge I always challenge myself with.
That's a big question and a fun one to pursue.
Yeah, no, definitely. But if it doesn't feel right to you and you're like, geez, this is not fun, this is not feeling right, then maybe you're approaching the painting. I tell students that. I'm like, you've got to make this feel like yourself. If you feel like painting very tight is not your thing, then loosen up. Go with the more brushy way. Or if you're painting very brushy and you're just making brush marks and it feels wrong and you tend to like to detail more, then you have to kind of go in the other direction. So people have to find what is it that reflects their own nature.
Great advice, Gabriella. I have nothing to add to that.
Okay. I don't know. I tell that to students all the time. And it's like some people are like, oh, you know, they stop fighting themselves. So,
and when you do, you just take this big sigh of relief and you're like, why was I fighting so hard against myself all this time and making myself so miserable? It's such a relief when you stop.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's what happens when you leave school. You're like, you're faced with yourself and you start to kind of see all the realities that who you are. Who are you?
That's a big question. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's a lifetime to figure that out. But
definitely. Definitely.
Asking the question in the first place is hugely important.
Yeah.
For your painting. Like, who am I as a painter? And I think it scares people to try to figure that out. At least it scared me, you know, this idea that I didn't know. Like, how could I not know? Like, I must not be a real artist if I don't know.
It's a scary question. We're all faced with it. But the more you paint, experience comes into play and you start to like have some experience behind you and you start to realize what works, what doesn't work, and what you do best at. And so it's, you know, this is a lifetime of learning.
Absolutely. Gabriella, thank you so, so much. This hour flew by.
I know. So much fun talking to you, Antrese. Thank you so much for having me on your excellent show. I really enjoyed it. And thank you again.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Gabriella, for sharing your story and the stories of these other artists. Also, a huge thank you to Holly Lane, who connected me with Gabriella. I have to say, a very, very long time ago. It took me a while to get connected with Gabriella, but I'm so, so glad I did. So you might remember Holly from my interview with her last year. If not, she is another artist you should definitely take the time to get to know. Go to savvypainter.com and click on the podcast link. That's where you're going to find show notes for this episode. There are examples of Gabriella's works, links to the artists that we spoke about, and also links to connect with Gabriella. And you can also see a lot more of her work at gabrielladeloso.com. The Savvy Painter podcast is made possible in large part by listeners like you. If you'd like to help out, it's quick, it's easy, and it is a huge, huge help to keep this show going. Just go to savvypainter.com/support. And with that, I have some very, very special people to thank. A huge, huge thank you goes out to Mr. Tom Breeden, Robert Doucette, Teresa Hill, Alchemy Works, Patricia Matranga Fine Art, Andy Dobie, Wright Design, Gabrielle McDermott, Alexis Redden, Tankersley Fine Arts, Don Chandler Fine Art, Kenneth Burke, Kathy Beeler, Kristen Curtin, Gail Height, Neely Arts, J.A. Moore, Shirley Williams, Ruth Kalb, Lois McCarthy, Deb Cook Shapiro, Kathleen Speranza, Bruce Garrity, and Melissa Nolan. You helped make these podcast episodes possible, and I am extremely grateful for your support. Thank you so much. One more thing I want to let you know. This year, you can expect a lot more workshops from Savvy Painter. If you are an artist who struggles with getting painting time in or feels like you're always busy but never really moving forward with your art, then my workshops just might interest you. Past workshops include Mindset Mastery, a 5-week online workshop to help you get past the roadblocks that keep you from painting. In it, we tackle the inner critic, fears of artists, and setting yourself up for a successful creative day. The workshop, How to Develop a Relationship with the Right Gallery, helped several artists find the right gallery and show their work. So if this is something that interests you, you can go to savvypainter.com/workshop and get on the email list. This is separate from the main list that tells you when a new episode comes out. This is just for the workshop, so you don't get quite as many emails, but when you do, there's always something really good happening. Sign up now and get a downloadable PDF with case studies that tell you exactly how 3 artists pushed through barriers that were getting in the way of their studio time. You can, for example, learn how Rhonda went from not wanting to call herself an artist to getting her very first solo show. Also, listen to an introverted artist describe how she built her confidence and then spoke in front of an audience of her peers. And you can discover the tools that Samantha used to take back her power after a decade of believing that she had no, I'm putting air quotes there, she had no talent. So again, go to savvypainter.com/workshop to reserve your place on the list. When you sign up, you get that downloadable case studies that I mentioned, but more importantly, you get exclusive invites to upcoming workshops. Most of the time when I launch a new program, it sells out before I ever announce it publicly. So reserve your spot now at savvypainter.com/workshop. Until next week, this is Antrese Wood with the Savvy Painter podcast. Thank you so much for listening.